This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the program, the history and legacy of gambling in Louisiana. When the state was hit by recession in the 80s and early 90s, Governor Edwin Edwards bet on legalized gambling to restore the economy. But the prospect of all that money led to corruption, and ultimately Edwards was convicted on charges of extortion, money laundering, and engaging in a criminal enterprise. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments this afternoon for our guest, journalist Tyler Bridges. He's the author of Bad Bet on the Bayou, The Rise of Gambling in Louisiana and the Fall of Governor Edwin Edwards. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Tyler Bridges is a reporter for the Miami Herald. In 1999, he was part of a team of Herald reporters that won the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. Bridges covered the legalization of gambling in Louisiana for the Times-Picayune of New Orleans, that before he joined the Miami Herald. In addition to Bad Bet on the Bayou, Tyler Bridges is the author of The Rise of David Duke. Bad Bet on the Bayou is published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Again, our telephone number is 333-9455. That's the number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Tyler Bridges, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Over the course of three decades, Edwin Edwards was elected governor four times. Why was he such a popular politician?
I think he fit the state's mood very well, Louisianians. Maybe the best phrase for the state is let the good times roll, and Edwards was certainly a person and a politician who believed that. He is openly a womanizer, a gambler. A person who likes to have a good time, and certainly there are a lot of people in Louisiana with that mood.
Hmm. If he was to stand for election today, could he win?
I don't think so. I think time has now passed him by. I think there is a bit of a different mood today. I think sort of Louisiana goes through moments where they are very much sort of liking the populist candidate, Huey Long, Earl Long, Edwin Edwards being the latest, and there are moments when they go through tired of the populism, and I think that's generally where they're at today. Plus, even Edwin Edwards, I don't think, could get elected after a conviction of bribery.
Yeah, but even through his trial and after his conviction, he was still a popular guy.
Oh, no doubt about that, Celeste. There's all sorts of people that don't think he should go to jail, even though he has been convicted. He hasn't gone to prison because he's out on appeal. But I would guess that the majority of Louisianians don't want him to go to prison. They still have an affection for him, and I think there's some people who think that he's suffered enough as it is. He's 73 years old. Let him live out his remaining years.
What is the status of his appeal at this point?
There was a lot of questions that came out of the trial. One of the jurors was removed by the judge, Frank Polozola, who said that the jury was just not doing his job and was refusing to deliberate. And the judge took a lot of, he shut down the court for 2 days to try to make that determination during the jury deliberations. And in the end, he removed that juror. Sort of known in Louisiana as juror number 68, because mm-hmm. all of the jurors were anonymous. And Edwards is now appealing, saying that juror 68 should not have been removed from the jury. He's appealing on other grounds as well. So Edwards was convicted over 10 counts last year, but just before he was going to actually have to go to prison in Texas, an appeals court stayed that sentence pending the governor's or former governor's appeal. And nothing else has happened since then.
No. What made Edwin Edwards the man he became? Tell us about his background.
Sure. He grew up very, very poor during the Great Depression. His grew up in central Louisiana, out in the in a rural area. His home had no running water, no electricity. He, as a teenager, became very enthralled with an obscure religion, the Nazarene religion. He was actually preaching it as a teenager. He's the kind of boy who is always the smartest and swiftest of the bunch, but he grew up in a very unsophisticated community. When he told his parents that he wanted to go attend Louisiana State University, which was only 90 miles away, his parents did not know where it was. But he went there, and he did very well, and he worked his way through school because he had no money. He ended up getting a law degree from Louisiana State University and settled in a little town in the Cajun country of Louisiana, a little town called Crowley, and hung out his shingle there, and ended up being elected to the Crowley City Council. He was elected to the Louisiana State Senate, then to Congress, and finally governor for the first time in 1971. And the man is just, I think he's the smartest person I've ever met in my entire life. He's just razor, razor sharp. He's the kind of politician that can really anticipate three chess moves ahead, what's going to happen. You can almost sort of look around the corner to see what's coming next, where no one else has that ability. And he also has this amazing ability to dance close to the line that separates legal and illegal activity. To use another analogy, if I may, he has this amazing ability where the trap door is about to open. At the last moment, he steps off the trap door, and it opens, and nothing happens to him, although he was finally caught in the end.
Yeah. What was it like covering him?
Well, as I said, he has this unbelievable charm. You know, almost can't help but be sucked in when you're with him because he is so funny. I mean, he's as funny as you know, Johnny Carson or David Letterman are. Just razor, razor sharp, funny wit, always telling great stories, and you can't help but like the guy. But he, you know, if you challenge him too much, he'll get testy with you. When I covered him when I was with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, more than once he yelled at me. And you know, that comes with the territory. But sharp, funny, brilliant, interesting man, but also a guy whose ethics and believe that he and his friends ought to make money while he was in political office.
Mm. You said a moment ago that he was a politician who danced close to the line. Now, prior to the corruption that brought him down in the 90s and his trial in the year 2000, what kind of a governor had Edwin Edwards been during his previous terms in office?
Well, he started out, ironically, as a reform governor when he was first elected in 1971. In fact, probably the achievement that he did that he was most important was he led the rewriting of Louisiana's constitution. Today's Louisiana modern constitution was put together, written under Governor Edwards. And so that was probably the most important thing he did, but he also played an important role in the 1970s in the state government raising a lot of money from the oil industry, and those were very good times in Louisiana. And during those years, Louisiana could laugh at Edwin Edwards' excesses. In his third term, he was elected. He had to sit out 4 years from 1980 to 84, and then he was elected again, beat an incumbent handily. That was the election in which he said that he would win the election unless he was caught in bed with a live boy or a dead girl. And during that campaign, he complained that the sort of indecisive governor was so slow that it would take him 90 minutes to watch 60 minutes. But that third term, he was indicted for corruption involving the sale of hospital permits that the government sells. And he was distracted by that, and he ended up being acquitted on that charge. By that time, the oil bust was hitting Louisiana, and Louisianans stopped laughing at his jokes, and they defeated him in 1987, the only time in his career he ever suffered a defeat. And then he chose to avenge that defeat in 1991 against Buddy Romer, who had beaten him 4 years earlier. And in that 1991 race, Louisiana has a lot of unique things, and one of them is the election system where there is a primary is not fought between Democrats and Republicans. Everyone is thrown together. And in that primary, in the end, Edwards ran first, and David Duke, the former former mm-hmm. Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard, who was riding a wave of white disaffection, finished second, and the incumbent governor finished third and out of the money, because the top two people then go off to the runoff in that race that sort of people called the race from hell. Edwards soundly beat David Duke and then took off for the last time in 1992. He takes office, and by then his chief goal was bringing the world's largest casino to New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about, before we go into the history of the legislation that put all of this into motion and that kind of thing, let's talk a little bit about Louisiana and New Orleans and its the history of gambling in the state and in the city. It's really interesting to me to realize that through your book that New Orleans was the gateway for poker and craps.
Yeah, I don't know that there is another state in our union that has a deeper, longer history with gambling than Louisiana. And as you mentioned, poker and craps were both brought to this country through New Orleans around 200 years ago. In fact, there was even a street in New Orleans that was called the Rue Craps because of the guy who brought it to Louisiana was a big player and owned some property in that area of the city where the street was named. And after that, you had riverboat gambling up and down the Mississippi with New Orleans the chief port. And after the Civil War, that was before the Civil War. After the Civil War, you had something called the Louisiana Lottery. It became this enormous nationwide enterprise. People all across the country played the Louisiana Lottery because other states did not have lotteries. And it became, in fact, the largest scandal in the history of gambling. The Louisiana Lottery became so corrupt. And finally, it took an act of Congress to shut it down under President Benjamin Harrison. So you had that scandal. And then in the 20th century, Louisiana and New Orleans began getting illegal slot machines that were brought to Louisiana by Huey Long in a deal that he had with a New York mobster named Frank Costello. And so these machines sprouted initially in New Orleans and then throughout South Louisiana. And a mobster that some people's name might recognize, Carlos Marcello, who became the mob chief in New Orleans. He ended up getting involved, and casinos, illegal casinos, sprouted around New Orleans in the late 1940s. And the corrupt sheriffs were paid off to allow this to happen. But it all came to a halt in the early 1950s as Senator Estes Kefauver mm-hmm. from Tennessee. And he brought an anti-gambling or crime investigating committee of Congress to New Orleans, and the national spotlight prompted the sheriffs to shut down these illegal casinos. And then there was a crime-busting superintendent of Louisiana State Police who sort of delivered the final blow and did raids all across Louisiana and shutting down the illegal casinos. And Louisiana didn't have gambling for a long time after that. It was really Edwards proposed gambling, a bunch of casinos in New Orleans in 1986, but the legislature didn't go along with it. But in 1990, the door was open when the voters approved a lottery. And then in 1991, was video poker was approved by the legislature, and so was riverboat gambling. And this actually occurred, ironically, under Buddy Romer in his last year of office. And then Edwards took office the next year. So really in the history of Louisiana, gambling has pretty much gone on. The only question whether it was illegal or legal, and what we're seeing today is legal gambling.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that even though gambling has a long history in Louisiana, it was a latecomer to this most recent wave of legalized gambling that we've seen in the U.S.
Yeah, although typical Louisiana, I think Louisiana now has more forms of gambling than any other state. And the state is now awash in gambling. And with it has come the political corruption that we've had with gambling in Louisiana in the past as well.
Mm. Was it because that for a while Louisiana was flush with oil money, that it didn't look to gambling as a way to boost its revenues?
Exactly. During the good days of the 1970s and then for part of the 80s, Louisiana did not need any other money than what oil provided to the state treasury. And then times got tough, and politicians, you know, they didn't want to raise taxes. Their constituents did not want to pay more taxes, and so legalizing gambling became a painless way, or at least a way of getting extra revenue without imposing extra taxes on their constituents.
Mm-hmm. So in 90, we have the lottery approved by voters, and then in 91, video poker and riverboat gambling, and then in 92, I believe, the casino for New Orleans is approved. Tell us how that measure, legalizing a casino in New Orleans, won legislative approval, because one day it was voted down, and the next day it came roaring back to life.
Yeah, and let me just take a moment to say about the video poker. The video poker is kind of like a slot machine, but you play poker on it. And the law allowed three video poker machines in every single establishment that had a liquor license. Everybody thought it would be every single restaurant and every single bar. And then they also put in something that people didn't really pay much attention to, which was to put in video poker machines at truck stops. Well, what happened is the truck stops all of a sudden sprouted across the state where there had not been one before, and they really became kind of sham casinos. They were allowed to have up to 50 video poker machines each, and today there are donut shops that have gotten liquor licenses in Louisiana so they can have video poker machines because they're so lucrative. But so Louisiana legalizes gambling, the video poker and the riverboats in 1991, and then Buddy Romer is knocked out in that 91 governor's race, and Edwards takes office. It was interesting, Celeste, because he said that this time he was going to be different. He was going to be a different governor. This one he was going to not engage in any of the stuff that had gotten him in trouble before. People were going to be proud of him. And he said, I really don't want much gambling, but that was not true.
Mm. Okay, so it's 1992 now, and Edwards is in office, and the measure legalizing a casino in New Orleans wins legislative approval. And one day it's defeated in the legislature, and the next day it comes back to life.
Yeah, that happens in Louisiana. The battleground for whether the casino would be legalized was the Louisiana House of Representatives. Everyone knew there was enough votes in the Senate, but it was uncertain in the House. And as you mentioned, the first time it came up, The House of Representatives of Louisiana defeated the bill to create a single land casino in New Orleans. It would be a monopoly casino. It was kind of a new kind of casino, whereas Mississippi and other states have said, you know, anybody who wants to can put up a casino anywhere. Here, the state of Louisiana was going to create a monopoly. And so the first time that the bill came up, it was defeated. And the Speaker of the House was a man named John Ilario. And he has a little vote counter in front of him. As the vote is going on, he and the clerk of the House, who stands right in front of them in the chamber, are the only people who know the running tally. There are votes of green buttons and red buttons up on the board above them that everyone can take a look at, but no one, unless they are, you know, extraordinarily guessers, knows the exact tally. But Ilario had seen that the vote had gotten above the minimum needed to pass the bill the first time. The number of votes needed is 53. That's the bare majority in the 105-member House. So the vote tally, as he's watching, it gets above 53, it gets up to 56, and then it drops down and it goes down to 43. And it came out in the press right afterwards that some Republican legislators and a couple of Democrats pushed the green button at first to try to confuse Ilario, because he had some extra votes in reserve that he would signal to some members in the chamber that if he needed them, they would vote for it. They were reluctant to do so unless he absolutely needed them. So they pushed the green button to kind of confuse Ilario initially, and then just before the voting machine was shut down and the vote was ended, they switched to the red button, so Ilario didn't think he needed those extra votes. So Ilario was a smart and crafty man. You don't get to be the Speaker of the House unless you're pretty crafty. And so he then put together a plan, and 3 days later, without any warning, he brought up the bill again. And he had put together a plan with the clerk of the House, who stood right in front of him, and he told the clerk that as soon as the vote counter got above 53, the little counter that only he and the Speaker could see, that the clerk was going to shut down the machine so no one could vote anymore, that votes would be locked in place. And so there would normally be another 10 to 15 seconds where members could vote while the speaker would say, are you through voting? And this was something the speaker would say several times, kind of to indicate to people that, you know, that the voting period was ending. And this time, as soon as the speaker began to say, are you, and this would be the first of, are you through voting, the clerk shut down the machine. And at that point, there was the 53 votes that were the bare minimum that was needed. And at least one member that was voting yes initially to try to confuse Ilario again was going to switch to the no. But there was incredible confusion. There was almost a fist fight broke out on the floor. It was a vote that was reminiscent of what Huey Long and Earl Long had done, you know, the most controversial vote in the Louisiana legislature in years and years and years, but the vote stood. And so the Louisiana got the single land casino in New Orleans through trickery.
Yeah. The power of a quick gavel.
Yes, and it's I think it kind of foreshadowed what was to come.
Yeah. What kind of a regulatory scheme did the state of Louisiana have in place? And this is a little confusing because there was a casino board and a gaming commission.
They created actually three different forms of regulation.
Okay.
One was to regulate. One was to decide, all right, who gets to actually operate this monopoly casino. Secondly, Louisiana in 1991 had legalized riverboat gambling, and they again had limited the number of licenses, which then gave the government power to award the licenses, and they were to award 15 riverboat licenses, and then the Louisiana State Police were to regulate the video poker. So you had all this different people regulating. And what happens so often is that you end up not being able to trust the regulators. Edwards put his own people in charge of each of those boards, and then Edwards intervened repeatedly, particularly with the riverboat board, to make sure that his allies, his friends, got the riverboat licenses. And when it came to the land casino board, which is a separate board, he did a very smart thing. He named as a chairman, and remember I was talking earlier about how smart Edwards is, he named as the chairman a former FBI agent. I mean, it sounded great. Former FBI agent is the chairman of the land casino board. What could go wrong? But he did. Also, Edwards did a very smart thing. This guy retired from the FBI, and there were staggered terms on this commission. And Edwards gave the FBI guy, a retired FBI guy, the one-year term. But the guy didn't realize it until after way into accepting the job. So his term ran out, and at that point, he was beholden to Edwards. So there ended up being a climactic vote to decide who would get this land casino license. And there was two different companies vying for the license, and it became intensely political. And it ended up being a surprise vote that one company won out over the other.
Hmm. Did Edwards play a direct role in who came out on top on the land casino?
There's a lot of speculation and controversy about that. My investigation was that he did not directly intervene. The company that won out was the big casino company called Harrah's, and they partnered up with a bunch of politically active Louisiana lawyers and businessmen who were close to Edwards. The company that lost out was a partnership formed by a Hawaiian resort developer named Christopher Hemeter, who is the most charming man you'll ever meet in your life. Just an incredible salesman. And Hemeter had partnered up with Caesar's Palace of Las Vegas. And so it looked like Hemeter was going to get it, but there was a surprise meeting the night before, secret meeting the night before the vote, where the Harrah's partners had this secret meeting with a congressman, an African-American congressman, and they met with one of the casino board members, this congressman, Cleo Fields, and asked her to pray and to vote with Harrah's Jazz. She was seen as being undecided at that moment, and she ended up casting what was the deciding vote because it was a 5-4 victory for the Harrah's Jazz team over the Hemeter Caesars team. And it was just a stunning vote.
Hmm. Now, the fact that Edwin Edwards had long been a gambler, and he was in charge of stacking up the regulatory bodies, Did that present a problem for him? Were there people in the legislature, were there people in the press that were saying, wait a minute?
Yeah, and even 60 Minutes did a show. They were tipped off, actually, by my newspaper that Edwards was going to be spending New Year's Eve from 1990, the last day of 1992, in gambling in Las Vegas. And so they had a hidden camera, followed him around and watched him playing craps, the incumbent governor. And the place that he played it was at Caesar's Palace, which by then was seeking the casino license. And actually what may have happened is that there was so much scrutiny on Edwards and Caesar's being his favorite place to gamble. He's a huge gambler, plays craps at Caesar's, that he may have in the end kept his hands off what happened, because his favorite place to gamble ended up not getting that land casino license. But as I said, there was an intense scrutiny of his gambling habits.
When did Edwards become involved in pulling the strings in licensing riverboats?
Again, it's interesting that the riverboat legislation passed under Buddy Romer in 1991, but it fell to Edwards when he took over the governor's mansion to appoint the regulatory board and put in his own people. And he let the chairman know who he favored to get the various riverboat licenses, and the licenses were given in stages. And then the final 7 of the 15 licenses were to be awarded in June of 1993, and the chairman of the board checked in with Edwards, and Edwards said that list is fine. But then Edwards double-crossed his chairman, and Edwards met with one of the other members the day before the vote and presented him with a different list and asked this board member to meet with his colleagues. And the next day, the colleagues told the chairman of the Riverboat Gambling Board that they had a different list, that it had been approved by the governor, and this chairman, a man named Ken Pickering, didn't believe it. But Pickering got outvoted repeatedly that day, and Edwards' friends, some of them had no business to be in the gambling industry, no experience. They got the riverboat licenses over some very big companies that had far more experience.
Hmm. Tyler Bridges is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his book, Bad Bet on the Bayou, The Rise of Gambling in Louisiana and the Fall of Governor Edwin Edwards. Tyler Bridges is a journalist, a reporter for the Miami Herald. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome in Champaign-Urbana. The number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Edwin Edwards went to trial twice in the 1980s. Those prosecutions failed. What led the FBI to begin the investigation that led ultimately to Edwards' conviction in the year 2000?
That's an interesting question. Obviously, the FBI had been interested in Edwards ever since. I think they always wanted to get him, but it's the kind of thing where you've tried to get him once and you failed, so you can't try to get him again unless you just have the best evidence. But it was really by chance that one day a lawyer was at a conference and asked to meet with an assistant United States attorney from New Orleans and explained to him that he had a couple of clients that were having some trouble in Texas and wondered if he could talk with the guy about the problem. The assistant United States attorney said, well, Texas is out of our jurisdiction. And the lawyer said, well, my clients have been doing some illegal stuff in Louisiana. And from that meeting, almost a chance encounter, the case got going. And the lawyer ended up bringing his clients into to New Orleans to meet with the FBI and the United States attorney's office and revealed that the illegality that his clients were involved in was with Governor Edwards, and Edwards had accepted $600,000 in cash payoffs at the governor's mansion from his clients. And from there, the federal government then was able to win permission to tap Edwards' phone, and that got enough information that they eventually were able to get a camera above Edwards' office, above Edwards in his office, and also to tap his phone at work. And from there, they just they drew a net, and they drew it closer and closer and closer to Edwards.
Yeah. When they started, they were looking for evidence of a deal involving graft over the location of a juvenile prison. And then that investigation kind of went by the wayside as they realized what else they had, right?
Well, what they found out is that as they listened in on Edwin Edwards' conversations, they discovered there was a lot more stuff that he was involved in. Edwin Edwards was always incredibly careful. Anytime he would be discussing something with somebody that might seem that it was over the line when he was governor, he had a way of talking to someone. He would say, look, you know, this is your decision. I want you to do what's the best for the people of Louisiana. But if I were in your shoes, I would do this and this and this. But I'm not giving you my, you know, this is for you to decide yourself. And Edwards did this to protect himself very craftily. You know, if anybody ever was asked on the stand, did, you know, Governor Edwards tell you what to do? No, the person would say. Yeah. And did Governor Edwards say, do what's best for the people of Louisiana? Yes. So Edwards would protect himself. But after his last term of office, he was now in his late 60s. His political career seemed over. I think he thought he was clear, and he was not quite as careful mm-hmm. on the phone as he used to be. And so he engaged in enough conversations of illegal activity for the feds to listen in. And as you mentioned, what started as an investigation of payoffs involving the siting of and creation of a juvenile prison in Louisiana, and then expanded into investigation into payoffs of for riverboat gambling that Edwards had gotten paid off by people to get licenses to operate in Louisiana.
Hmm. You mentioned that Edwards was less careful when he was out of office, but early in the book, I want to share with listeners, you say the way of doing business in politics in Louisiana, the saying goes, don't use mail if a phone call will do, don't use a phone call if a conversation will do, don't talk to somebody if a nod or a blink
actually, if I can jump in here.
Yeah.
This is Earl Long. This is advice that
okay.
he once gave. He said, don't write anything you can phone. Don't phone anything you can talk. Don't talk anything you can whisper. Don't whisper anything you can smile. Don't smile anything you can nod. And don't nod anything you can wink.
Oh, I'm so glad you broke in and with the correct quote. And who said it?
That was Earl Long, who served as governor 3 times, and that he was Huey's younger brother.
Hmm.
People may remember him being portrayed in the Paul Newman movie Blaze.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us in Eureka, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was just wondering whether it's legal for us to talk about this over the phone, but I'll go ahead anyway. It seems to me there are a lot of comparisons coming up between Illinois and Louisiana in that the gambling industry here is so completely cagey about getting every politician involved. I think of Peoria. The paradise is in East Peoria, but it seems like every politician has been sort of brought on board. And from our governor, which the very first thing he did was he allowed that the fact that the riverboats didn't have to go out and cruise anymore. But and another thought came to mind that from a program on Illinois Public Radio, State Week in Review, and which said that the top political action committee giving was done by the political action committees for the gambling interests. Would you say that is pretty well, you may not know Illinois, but is that pretty well true of a lot of gambling interests? They seem to be so thorough in tying up all the loose ends and getting anyone with any authority or power behind them and going ahead, so hardly anyone can give them any opposition once they've got going.
Yeah, I actually have a bit of familiarity with Illinois. As you mentioned, what the gambling industry does, they have so much cash. They end up hiring all of the law firms and all the politically influential people, the architects, the union people, and certainly that happened in Louisiana. They hired all sorts of folks, and today the gambling industry is the single most powerful industry in the state. They've supplanted the petrochemical industry, which always had been the most powerful. And
mm-hmm.
I know in Illinois, for example, that wasn't Governor, former Governor Thompson, hadn't he been a U.S. prosecutor?
Mm-hmm. Yes, for the Northern District of Illinois, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't he get all sorts of payments after he left office from the gambling industry to represent them?
He may have.
Yeah, I know that to be true. I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens. Sort of somebody, you know, you kind of think, wait a second, somebody who was once a prosecutor mm-hmm. ends up getting hired, but so many people end up being for sale. And I'm not saying it's illegal, although certainly there have been cases of it. But they can hire so many different people. And if I could just, another part of your question, which was, or comment, which had to do with, you know, it's gambling starts as one thing, but so often, and this is, it ends up being another.
Mm-hmm.
In Louisiana, the boats were going to sail. Well, they don't sail anymore.
Yes, yes, yes. The present governor's first act, as I remember it, legislative, is they got through a bill that they didn't have to sail anymore.
And so people end up thinking they're going to have sort of limited gambling, but it never happens that way. Gambling always becomes much more than what people think they're going to get. And that happens not only in Illinois and Louisiana. Same thing happened in Mississippi. It happens in state after state. Once they get in the door, they become so powerful politically that they're hard to say no to. And if they say, hey, we're bringing in, $10 million a year, well, we could bring in $15 million if you let us do that. And at that point, the politicians are addicted to gambling revenue, and it's hard for them to say no.
May I make two quick final comments, please?
Sure.
You realize that Thompson made his mark when he prosecuted former Governor Kerner for fixing horse racing dates in Illinois. Are you aware of that?
I didn't know. In the early 70s.
And second, a thought comes from when Walter Cronkite did a documentary on gambling, and he said the largest buyer of TV advertising in every major market in the country is gambling interest. And I can believe it just watching the Peoria stations. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. That's how Jim Thompson made his name, was his prosecution of Otto Kerner.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the FBI and the investigation, and the FBI is gathering all kinds of evidence. They have a lot of evidence in hand, and this is so interesting to me. Despite what seems like just a ton of evidence, overwhelming evidence, the U.S. attorney, speaking of U.S. attorneys, Eddie Jordan Jr., insists for a time there isn't enough evidence. Why was Jordan hesitant?
Well, Edwin Edwards, not many people thought he would ever be convicted in a Louisiana courtroom. If you assume that his being elected four times as governor gives him a better knowledge and better ability to touch the Louisiana people and get them to support him than any other person in the state, understanding the psyche of the Louisiana voter, well, he probably has pretty good odds at beating any charge against him, a juror of 12 ordinary citizens. So the government wanted to have overwhelming evidence against Edwards before they could finally get him, and they got a ton of evidence against him. As I said earlier, they kept drawing the net closer and closer around him, or more and more around him, and at a certain point they thought that they had enough, although they had to end their investigation early because a newsman found out about it and threatened to go public with it.
Hmm. Also, Jordan chose not to seek an indictment against Cleo Fields. Why was Fields spared?
Cleo Fields is an interesting person. As I mentioned a few minutes ago,
mm-hmm.
he had this secret meeting that had not been public before my book came out to influence a member of the Land Casino Board. And Cleo Fields had run for governor in 1995, just a young, energetic black politician, really the state's most powerful black politician he became, but just seen as a real kind of energetic guy, and it really kind of becomes a disappointment to find out that, like so many Louisiana politicians, he's really not the man he seemed to be. And he also got mixed up in this with Governor Edwards and some of the stuff that went on. And I mentioned earlier, Celeste, that there was a camera above Edwards in his office, and this camera above Edwards in his office one day captured Governor Edwards handing Cleo Fields $20,000 of cash, and Cleo Fields stuffing it into his pocket. And the conversation, it was pretty clear that this involved a payoff for someone on the a casino board. But the U.S. attorney, Eddie Jordan, chose not to to indict Congressman Fields, then Congressman Fields. He's now in the state Senate of Louisiana. And all of the people involved in the case, other than the U.S. attorney, wanted Cleo Fields prosecuted or to be indicted. And Eddie Jordan, the U.S. attorney, simply said he didn't think there was enough evidence. Now there's all sorts of conspiracy theories as to why Eddie Jordan didn't want to prosecute Cleo Fields, but that's the way it went.
Even with video of Cleo Fields putting all that money into his vest pocket,
Yeah.
That's amazing to me.
Well, there's a lot of amazing things that happens with Louisiana and Louisiana politics.
And because Fields wasn't indicted, ultimately, that led to a not guilty verdict for Greg Tarver, another politician.
That's right. Greg Tarver was the kind of politician who never introduced a bill but had enormous power. He would quietly put stuff into legislation that wouldn't get any attention, but that would bring a lot of money back to his district. A lot of times it would go back to his friends. He once told me, he said, well, if I'm not going to help my friends, who am I going to help? My enemies?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of captures his approach to politics. And Greg Tarver's family, he was a state senator, still is. Greg Tarver's family made a lot of money off of gambling, getting contracts from the riverboats in his legislative district, which is up in the Shreveport area. And Greg Tarver was indicted along with Edwards, and in the end was acquitted.
This is speculation, but if I were in your shoes as an investigative reporter, I would wonder, did Eddie Jordan know that without Fields, the jury wouldn't convict Tarver, and is there some kind of Jordan-Tarver connection?
I don't know of a specific Jordan-Tarver connection. There were some people who made more speculation about Jordan and Cleo Fields. But certainly people made that argument beforehand that if you don't indict Cleo Fields, you're not going to get the other guy, Tarver. I guess I've come to learn as a reporter that U.S. attorneys are not free from politics, that definitely politics affects what they do. There was actually, to give Eddie Jordan some credit, he is a Democrat, so was Edwin Edwards, and there were people who thought that Eddie Jordan would not want to prosecute Edwin Edwards because they were of the same party, but he did indeed successfully prosecute Edwards, and now Eddie Jordan is looking to run for the local district attorney in New Orleans. A man named Harry Connick Sr., the father of the singer, is the long-time prosecutor there. And just to throw in another little historical piece of information, Harry Connick beat Jim Garrison, the guy who was immortalized in the JFK movie. He was the guy that tried the people in the Kennedy assassination, but so it went from Jim Garrison to Harry Connick, and now it may go to this man, Eddie Jordan.
Eddie Jordan. And what's Cleo Fields' political capital these days?
Well, Cleo Fields was going to get a job with the White House until the White House learned about this payment from Edwards, payoff or payment, however you want to characterize it, and he ended up losing his seat in Congress because of it was a minority-drawn district, and the courts changed it, and now then it became a white majority, and so he chose not to run for re-election, but he was elected to his old state senate seat in Louisiana State Senate. But where he had once been the most powerful black politician in the state, he has lost that. He's probably gone about as far as he can go, so his involvement in this Louisiana gambling stuff has harmed his political career, but you know, one thing, if I can jump in here, Celeste, I have created my own web page, and if any of your listeners want to get more information on the book, and you know, there's various reviews and things like that. If I can mention that, it's
sure.
www.tylerbridges.com. That's TYLERBRIDGES. That's all one word, lower caps. So www.tylerbridges.com. You know, this book took me 5 years to write. I did an awful lot of research, talked to more than 100 people. I really wanted to piece it together to make the reader feel like they were there when the dirty deed was going down. It's sort of a form of journalism called narrative journalism,
mm-hmm.
I guess. And sort of Louisiana politics can be stranger than fiction, and I tried to write it in a lot of ways like fiction.
Yeah.
But you know, everything in it is true.
Yeah, I think that we can say the same about Illinois politics. And
well, I know I've heard a lot of similarities. I don't know Illinois politics well enough, but certainly I've heard a lot about Chicago politics over the years.
Yeah. Well, you quote James Carville early in the book, a native of Louisiana, saying, you know, that Louisiana would do better if another state handled the money, and we were left to provide the food and entertainment.
Yeah, well, here it's, we're not, Carville from Louisiana says, we're just not genetically disposed to handle money. We ought to bring in the legislature from another state, maybe Wisconsin or Minnesota, to handle our money. In return, we'll handle the cooking and entertainment for them.
Yeah.
They'll handle our fiscal oversight, and we'll handle their cultural matters.
Yeah. I notice here that Illinois is not on his short list.
No.
Before we go, I'm curious, you know, given all the attention now that is being paid to gambling and the problems with it, what do you think the future is for legalized gambling?
Well, interestingly enough, in your area, you've got a Methodist minister named Tom Gray, who has become the leading anti-gambling guy across the country. He leads the national, I can't remember the exact name of the group, but he has done an amazing job of sort of getting grassroots people going everywhere across the country. Anytime something pops up, Tom Gray will be there. He's very good at getting publicity. He's very good at rallying the troops. And so Reverend Gray is doing his thing around the country, will continue to do so. But I think as times get tough in the economy, politicians will naturally look to gambling as a way of getting extra revenue. It happens with the lottery. When one state gets a lottery, the adjoining state feels the pressure to get a lottery as well. We've seen that particularly in the South, and states get Louisiana ended up getting riverboat gambling because Iowa and Illinois had it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, when one state gets it, another state, particularly a neighboring state, feels pressure to do so because they, you know, some of their residents go over there and gamble. And so, I think we're going to see continued pressure to try to legalize gambling. And what happens, Celeste, is once a state legalizes gambling, it's very hard to get rid of it. So a state can try several times, or people in a state or the gambling interest can try several times in a state to get gambling, and they can fail several times. All they have to do is succeed once.
Mm. We have to leave it there, Tyler Bridges. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Tyler Bridges has been our guest. You can find him on the web at tylerbridges.com. Also, if you're interested in reading more, look for his book, Bad Bet on the Bayou, The Rise of Gambling in Louisiana and the Fall of Governor Edwin Edwards.